Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the UN climate deal, which 195 nations just agreed to in Paris, and speak with Robert Stavins, who is just back from Paris. He is a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School, and lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We will assess the likelihood of greenhouse gas reduction targets being met to keep the Earth's warming below 2 degrees Celsius and discuss complaints by critics that the deal does not go far enough. Then we'll speak with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. He joins us to discuss his belief that we are now entering the post-carbon era and that global warming deniers will become less and less relevant as the world moves to deal with the growing threat of climate change. Even though key Republicans like Lamar Smith of Texas, the chairman of the House Committee on Science, Space and Technology, are climate change deniers. Then finally, Sebastian Copeland joins us in the studio. He's an award-winning photographer, extreme athlete, filmmaker, and environmental activist, and the author of the new book, Arctica, The Vanishing North, which provides an extraordinary portrait of a seldom-traveled pristine wonderland that both pays homage to the beauty of one of nature's last true wildernesses while drawing awareness to its perilous plight. And joining us now is Robert Stavins, who's a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School and a lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He just returned from Paris, where a deal was made on climate change. Everybody, including the president, is hailing this deal as an historic breakthrough. And obviously there's some criticism that it wasn't sufficient. You were there for 10 days. What's your reading on the deal?
So, Ian, my reading is that it really is a landmark climate accord that was gaveled through on December 12th, yesterday, in Paris. This is providing a very broad foundation for what I would call meaningful progress on climate change going forward, and it represents a really dramatic departure from the Kyoto Protocol and 20 years of climate negotiations.
And the criticism coming from, for example, Dr. Hansen, former NASA chief scientist, that an opportunity was missed because of the low price of oil now, that there could have been some kind of agreement on a tax of something along those lines, which the public could bear at this point with low oil prices. I mean, obviously there was a presence of Saudi Arabia and Venezuela and other big oil producers there. What's your sense about how that wrangling took place and who came out on top?
Well, there are two different issues, Ian, in what you just referred to. One is the degree of ambition of the Paris Agreement, and the other is the use of a centralized instrument like a tax. In terms of the latter, the idea of using a tax globally through the Paris Agreement is absolutely absurd. That would be a violation of international sovereignty. So Dr. Hansen, who I'm sure is a very good climate scientist, that's just completely unreasonable. It's inconsistent with everything about international law as well as these specific negotiations. The United Nations does not have policing power to put in place taxes, collect revenue, or do any such thing. Fundamental part of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, going back to 1992 when this started, is national sovereignty for each country, that they choose how to achieve their individual targets and goals. Now, I suppose what Dr. Hansen or others will criticize that can be discussed is the degree of ambition of the Paris Agreement, which is not the agreement itself. It's these so-called intended national determined contributions, INDCs, that 185 countries submitted. But I think that itself is a misread and reveals a fundamental misunderstanding about how climate negotiations are going and where we now stand. So if you don't mind, I'm going to offer to you a metaphor as the easiest way to explain this. It's as if you and I are walking down the street and we see a sign for a 70-story office tower is going to be constructed, and there's a fence around the work site, and we're quite impressed. And we see that the construction has already gone two stories up. And then we walk over to the construction site and we look over the fence and we see that the square footage, the footprint of this foundation, of this building going up, that's claiming it's going to be 70 stories tall, is 10 feet by 10 feet. And we laugh because we know that it's going to collapse. It's not of sufficient breadth to do anything. That's the Kyoto Protocol with the current structure we've been working with for now 20 years, actually. Because under the Kyoto Protocol, which was only for the industrialized countries as they were in 1995, they account for a declining share of global emissions. In fact, the Kyoto Protocol now accounts for 14% of global emissions. That's Europe and New Zealand. So any kind of ambition was impossible. And the Kyoto Protocol with that old structure accounts for 0% of emissions growth, because the emissions growth is in China, India, Brazil. It's in the large emerging economies. The new approach under Paris is as if you and I go back to the construction site. We see, oh, we can no longer see the two stories up. That's Dr. Hansen complaining. It's not the ambition it was before. We look over the fence and we see the foundation for this office tower, 70 stories tall eventually, is now a full square block. That's the that's the new Paris Agreement. The new Paris Agreement, unlike the 14% coverage, now has 185 countries on board, accounting for 96% of global emissions. That's a necessary condition for progress. Now, is it a sufficient condition? Of course not. Ambition is also important, and there are mechanisms within the Paris Agreement to increase ambition over time.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Stavins, who's a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School and a lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He just returned from Paris, where the UN Conference on Climate Change, which included 185 countries, came to an historic agreement. And, of course, there's always the old adage that the perfect is the enemy of the good, and I think your analogy is well taken. That's not to say that, and of course it's pretty clear that President Obama was wise not to craft this deal, particularly for the United States, that didn't involve a treaty. Already, of course, the House of Representatives is trying to undermine his Clean Power Initiative. Will the Congress be able to undermine the funding for the less developed nations that is a part of this deal, do you think?
Well, the key question is twofold. Will they be able to undermine this funding? And, you know, it's going to be very difficult for the administration to come up with $3 billion that it pledged. It's not impossible. They can move around funding within the State Department, so that repurpose funds, so that's going to be taking one kind of foreign aid and changing it to another. What's more important, really, with this is that the key source of funds for this so-called climate finance to developing countries from the wealthier countries needs to be through the private sector. Back at the time of the Waxman-Markey legislation, which allowed offsets in developing countries through the so-called Clean Development Mechanism, the best estimates at the time from the Congressional Budget Office is that was going to leverage $17 billion per year of foreign direct investment. That's the way it's going to go forward, is with foreign direct investment from the private sector, not through foreign aid. It's not only politically difficult to do it through foreign aid, I actually think it would be inappropriate.
So what role do you think the Bill Gates of the world will play, since they were pretty prominent there in Paris?
Well, it's somewhat, I suppose, an inspirational role, as well as, you know, there is some meaning to it of putting that money behind it. But the money that they're putting forward for investment in invention and innovation of energy efficiency and other carbon-friendly technologies, I wouldn't call it a drop in the bucket, but it's a small part of what eventually will be required. The only way, in my view, as an economist, that sufficient funding for technology invention and innovation is going to be there is when we have more aggressive climate policies, including in the United States, it would be a nationwide carbon pricing mechanism, whether that's a upstream cap and trade system or a carbon tax.
Well, obviously, as you, I'm sure, are aware, Robert Stavins, there's a lot of criticism from the Republicans in Congress. But it would seem to me that just broadening it out and trying to be objective about this, the fact that I think the consciousness of everybody on this planet has, I think, been somewhat raised by what just happened. There's a sense that the world has gotten together to deal with a clear and present danger. Do you think that that's going to trump? I mean, we've had this and we still have a residue of climate denial, and it's always been pretty well funded. Do you see that quarter baying into the wind as the, you know, to use that metaphor of the wind, that, you know, those that are trying to deal with this reality have the wind at their back now?
So, you know, my view is that the very vocal opposition to climate policy, and in some cases climate skepticism, that we hear, particularly from Republicans and, for that matter, from coal state Democrats, during this election season, is not a representation, for example, of the Republican electorate in the United States. And we know this from the polls, including very recent polls, in which more than half of the Republican electorate takes climate change seriously, and approximately half favor domestic action on climate change. What we're seeing in the presidential elections and from these very vocal members of the Republican Party who are very conservative is simply a manifestation of political polarization. And it's not really about climate change. It is about some much broader issues of what I would call populism from the right. And climate change is essentially collateral damage in this. It's ideological. And unfortunately, and it's hard for someone like myself, a professor, since my job is generating and communicating information, it's difficult for me to accept this, but when you have an ideological divide like we have in the United States on this issue, more information doesn't necessarily change people's views. So think about abortion. You know, whether you, whichever side of that issue you're on, more scientific information about the gestation process, the reproduction process of humans, is not going to move anyone from one side of the fence to the other, because they treat it as an ideological, a moral, and ethical issue. And that may be understandable in the abortion case, but climate change is a scientific, economic, and therefore political challenge. But it's going to be very difficult to get over that. I think we eventually will, but it's something quite unique about the United States.
And obviously, there is a question of how much reality intrudes on ideology, or even in this case, perhaps ignorance. But the fact that 185 countries got together, responsible for 96% of the world's emissions, and made a deal, that's a headline. That's a headline that does resonate, I think, with most of the planet.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. It is quite remarkable. Also, we should note, and I'm not by any means partisan. You know, I've worked with Republicans, equally with Democrats, both parties in the White House and with Congress over the years. But the Obama administration really does merit tremendous credit, because it was the Obama administration working with others, New Zealand delegation in particular, also the EU, and a number of them, that over now, going back to 2009, that they crafted, worked with others to develop this new approach, which enabled such a larger coalition to be put together. So they really deserve tremendous credit. Having said that, where these ideas originally came to the floor, believe it or not, was in Bali in the annual negotiations in 2007, when they were introduced by the U.S. delegation, which was the George W. Bush administration. So all in all, the U.S. really merits credit, or some people may want to say blame, for this new structure that was finally realized in Paris.
And I take it that the new structure is based upon an idea, particularly amongst the less developed nations, that there'll be a review process along the way, and there are probably growing incentives, I imagine, for people to meet these targets. Is that the built-in mechanism?
So there is a built-in mechanism for a 5-year review period. However, let me correct one thing. It was the United States and Europe that were pushing for that. The developing world, led by the Chinese and the Indian delegations, were working very hard in Paris against it. They didn't want that review because they don't want ratcheting up, because ratcheting up of the contributions is going to include them. So they were very, very opposed. They were opposed to transparency requirements so you can actually verify what countries are doing, and they were opposed to this notion, to any language which suggested that the 5-year renewals would result in ratcheting up of the degree of ambition. Eventually, though, they gave in on that. And that's why so much about this agreement is what the U.S. wanted, it, partly in response to Republican opposition in the past to Kyoto. But that's what's ironic now about hearing from Republicans about their objections to the new accord, because it was designed for them.
Well, it would seem, though, that as, you know, even, first of all, a lot of the critics are suggesting that the 2 degrees Celsius target is unlikely to be met over the next few decades on the current trajectory, and that it will take a lot of, you know, radical change. This is an incremental change, but my sense is that it's based upon, to some extent, the reality that the reality of what's happening to the planet is increasingly stark, isn't it?
Well, you have to not look. It's very important not to look at what the initial increments are. Actually, even this initial set of INDCs is remarkably ambitious. I mean, the anticipated business as usual temperature increase this century, if without the Paris Agreement, is about 6 to 7 degrees centigrade. With the Paris Agreement, and obviously there's lots of uncertainty, and I'm assuming implementation in various countries, we're looking at something like 3.5 degrees centigrade. Is that above 2? Yes, that's above 2, but it's a remarkable bending of the curve with just the initial set of contributions.
But the hope is that there'll be more and more pressure to reach that target, even if they're shooting above it.
Well, they'll, you know, in over a period of time, there are two mechanisms, really, which come to the fore. One is technological change, what economists call exogenous technological change. Because energy comes at a price, even without any kind of policies, economies have been coming in the industrialized world less energy-intensive and therefore less carbon-intensive over time. That's going to continue. In other words, the next time they come back, the cost of abatement is a little bit less than it was before. And then policies themselves influence technological change, so you get a very positive feedback effect. The other way in which they anticipate that this will work is what political scientists refer to as naming and shaming. If you have transparency there, which is cooked now into the Paris Agreement, if you have that, then countries will not want to be the one who is, you know, a laggard compared to others. China's position is breathtakingly different than what it was. The two joint announcements of President Obama and President Xi have demonstrated the tremendous convergence between the two largest emitters, which was probably the most important change that's taken place that really led up to the success of Paris.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Robert Stevens, to return to the point that you made earlier, that this UN deal in Paris was specifically designed as a collective agreement respecting everybody's sovereignty, and there was no imposition, and there's certainly no mechanism for taxing now that energy is at a low cost. But my understanding is that there was, in one of the draft agreements, there was a provision to basically stop or curtail or reduce investments in fossil fuel. That was apparently struck out, but how binding would it have been under the mechanism that you described?
Well, again, it is completely outside of the jurisdiction for the United Nations to specify what policy instruments should be used with any of the member countries. So that's out of the question. There is a parallel move, actually, through the G20 and through the OECD, to reduce fossil fuel subsidies. The worst fossil fuel subsidies, by the way, are in the large developing countries, the large emerging economies. They're not in the industrialized world. But there is a move to, in parallel, remove those, because removing a subsidy has the same effect. Removing a subsidy on fossil fuel has the same effect of imposing a tax. And so that move is taking place and is continuing.
And that's largely China and India.
Well, Indonesia, Brazil, a lot of developing countries, they do it for, you could say, political reasons or distributional equity reasons, to keep down costs for low-income populations.
And the two countries that had leadership that were fairly hostile to making a deal, Australia and Canada, leadership changed. Was there a noticeable difference in the positions of those countries? Because they are, Australia has the worst footprint per capita, I think, along with the United States.
Well, you know, both of those countries, I've dealt with them. I've dealt with their negotiating teams now for quite a few years. Both of them, I would actually say something that stands out about them is that they have excellent negotiating teams, and the people down in the ministries who don't change when the politicians at the top, the political appointees, change, just like in the United States, the bureaucrats remain. they've been very good all along. Now, obviously, right now in Paris, the Canadian team was overjoyed with the change of political leadership, and they played, the Canadian team in particular, played a very important role, actually, in the negotiations in Paris. They played a key role in terms of allowing for what's called linkage, which means different countries cooperating on achieving their emissions reductions, which is a very important element in the Paris Agreement, and I'd give Canada a lot of credit for it being there.
Well, Robert Stevens, I thank you very much for filling us in on this historic agreement.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Stevens, who's a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School and a lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He just returned from Paris, where the United Nations Conference on Climate Change, including 185 of the world's countries, made this historic agreement, which affects 96% of all CO2 emissions. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how we are entering the post-carbon era and that global warming deniers will become less and less relevant as the world moves to deal with the growing threat of climate change. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's the co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to be with you.
And I imagine, Michael, since you've been involved in the climate wars, that the fact that 195 countries responsible for 96% of the global emissions of CO2 have come to an agreement in Paris. It's obviously getting a lot of publicity around the world. It's hard to believe that all the countries in the world would gather over something that's supposed to be a hoax, according to the deniers. So do you think that we've reached a point of critical mass where we won't have to deal with that sort of obdurate resistance that's been around for some time?
Well, I hope so. I think the discussion, frankly, has moved on. And I do think that those who still deny that there's even a problem are increasingly irrelevant because the serious discussion, the adults in the room, are now very much engaged in the far more worthy discussion of what to do about this problem. And I think the agreement in Paris makes it clear that we are seeing the end of the age of fossil fuels. We are ready now to move forward. And if we move forward now, we do still have time to avert dangerous climate change.
So what kind of mischief, then, can the House of Representatives get up to? We've got Lamar Smith, the Texas Republican chairman of the House Committee on Science and Space Technology, Science, Space, and Technology, and he, of course, is a global warming denier along with his counterpart on the Republican side. Part of the deal, of course, is for the rich nations to subsidize the poor nations in terms of helping them meet their targets. I think the U.S. is committed to about $3 billion. Do you think the president can find $3 billion without them on the House side blocking him?
That's a good question. And the devil is indeed in the details. And part of the reason, in fact, that we don't technically have a ratified treaty, this wasn't officially voted upon, it doesn't have the force of law, is because, unfortunately, here in the U.S., we do have an intransigent Congress led by Republican climate change deniers like Lamar Smith, who will do everything they can to throw a monkey wrench in the works and to block progress. And so I think it's going to be necessary to find inventive ways, for the president to find inventive ways to meet our obligations in the face of that intransigence. But I do think that there is a commitment on the part of the administration to do everything they can to deliver in good faith what they have committed to in Paris.
And, of course, that's the key, isn't it, the follow-through, whether, I mean, there is a mechanism to revisit it in 5 years' time.
Right.
So what's your sense on how seriously these 195 countries are going to take the follow-through, which is really the key part of it?
Yeah, so I think that there is a collective peer pressure, as it were, here. I think that countries are looking at each other and expecting that others will keep the commitment that they have made in Paris. I think the success of this agreement will require good faith on the part of the various nations that have made commitments in Paris. Again, as we said before, it doesn't have the force of law, but I do think that no nation wants to be looked at by the rest of the world as having been the reason for failure in this effort to tackle climate change. Ultimately, I think we may be in a position, say 4 or 5 years from now, where we may have a Congress that is willing to ratify a formal agreement. And so I think maybe part of the thinking here is let's get as firm a voluntary set of commitments as we can here now and revisit this down the road when perhaps the political environment in the United States is more conducive to, again, ratifying an official treaty that will have the force of law. I think that's probably the thinking here.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And his books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. And in terms of the fossil fuel lobby, and of course Saudi Arabia and Venezuela were resisting efforts to curb fossil fuel investment, but essentially my understanding is that this was a UN deal that didn't involve imposing anything on anybody because of the nature of sovereignty amongst the member states of the United Nations. And so it's not an agreement. Dr. Hansen, the former chief scientist at NASA, complained that the deal didn't put a tax on fossil fuels, particularly at a time when the cost of energy is so low, with oil being now about $35 a barrel. Yeah. That my understanding is that that's just not realistic. It's not how the climate conference was arranged, you can't impose taxes across the board. So what's your understanding about what kind of binding agreements there are to curb investments in fossil fuels?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think that I have the greatest respect for James Hansen, but I do think that is an unreal expectation, unrealistically high expectation that the nations of the world would agree to impose something like a carbon tax. In part because obviously, the sovereign nations have the right to determine what financial instruments make the most sense to them in terms of tackling this problem. There are many approaches to tackling the problem to decreasing carbon emissions. Taxing carbon is one of them, but there are tradable emissions rights, cap and trade, so-called fee and dividend. There are other instruments for pricing carbon or incentivizing clean energy. For example, Germany has a feed-in tariff to incentivize clean energy, and that has led them to make amazing progress over the past several years to where they're now generating 30% of all of their electricity from renewable energy. So I think individual nations need to have the, the freedom to determine how best they can meet their obligations. There is, you mentioned Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has committed to lower their carbon emissions. So, they are part of this agreement. But of course, there is no force of law. So the devil is in the details. We'll have to see as things move forward if the various nations are indeed making good on their pledges. I would note that by some measures, some countries like China are actually going beyond the obligations they've made. China is now decreasing their usage of coal even faster than they had committed to in the bilateral agreement with the U.S. last year. So I think we are seeing some progress here.
In terms of the target of not allowing the Earth to warm more than 2 degrees centigrade, obviously, the understanding was that that wasn't realistic, and the targets that have been agreed to, I think, are about, 3 to 3.5% or thereabouts, not the dire 60%, which is the trajectory that we're on. So the Pacific nations that are seeing the sea level rise already, they're basically saying, even 2 degrees and we're right. It's all over for us. So how do you foresee that this interim period where you have the 5-year review coming up? Obviously, as reality intrudes in the form of rising sea level, that's inexorable.
Right.
It's like King Canute trying to stop the tide. So how do you think, do you think the pressure's going to grow on people to meet these targets because of the external reality of what's happening to the planet?
I think so, and that's why I think it's critical that this agreement put us on the right path. As you noted, this agreement, even if all of the countries make good on their pledges, that's not enough to get us below what many scientists feel is the dangerous level of warming, 2 degrees Celsius, 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit warming of the globe. Even if all of the signatories, or not the signatories, but the commitments from the nations participating in Paris, even if they all make good on those commitments, it's enough to maybe get us about halfway to where we need to be. Halfway from business as usual warming, which, as you said, potentially more than 5 degrees Celsius warming of the globe by the end of the century. That would be catastrophic if we do nothing. These agreements, these commitments get us about halfway to the 2 degree Celsius mark. So it gets us to the point where we're starting to turn the corner. We're not turning the corner fast enough. And so it's going to be critical that in the follow-up conferences 4 or 5 years from now, that we get even more firm commitments from the various participating nations so that we can still avert dangerous climate change. But as you know, who's to say what dangerous climate change is? We often bandy about this number 2 degrees Celsius. But in fact, if you're a low-lying island nation, for that matter, if you're California dealing with the worst drought on record, dangerous climate change has already arrived. And so there is this aspirational statement, in essence, in the agreement that the aim is to hold warming to substantially lower than 2 degrees Celsius, no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is the number that many of these low-lying island nations wanted a commitment to. There's no firm commitment to that number, but there is sort of an aspirational statement that we want to hold warming to significantly less than 2 degrees Celsius. This agreement won't get us there, but it at least makes sure that we're on the path so that in subsequent agreements we can get there. It preserves the possibility of getting there.
And does this agreement depend upon technological breakthroughs or the increase of wind and solar and other renewables? Are they factored in an aspirational sense, or are they factored in, in a realistic sense?
Yeah, so I think it's sort of implicit, right? If countries are going to continue to meet their energy demand while cutting carbon emissions, there's no two ways about it. They're going to have to transition to non-carbon energy, to renewable energy. Now, there is a group, Mark Jacobson at Stanford University, has done a number of studies, credible studies, peer-reviewed studies, demonstrating that it is possible here in the U.S. for us to get to essentially 100% non-fossil fuel energy by the middle of this century. So we can get there. The challenge is, in the meantime, we have to find a way to continue to meet energy demand while not continuing to escalate our emissions of carbon. And that's going to require some creative solutions. I don't think it requires undiscovered technology. We can scale up existing renewable energy technology to the point where it can satisfy our energy demand. The problem is that it will take some time, decades, to build that new infrastructure. So in the meantime, we're going to have some difficult decisions to make. Is there a role for nuclear energy? Folks like Hansen are very bullish on the role of nuclear energy. I'm sort of an agnostic in that regard, but I do think that that's the sort of conversation we're going to need to have. You know, what options are we willing to put on the table as we find a bridge to a fossil fuel-free future?
Well, Marco Mann, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Marco Mann, who's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He is a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined in the studio by Sebastian Copeland, the author of the new book, Arctica, The Vanishing North.
In the sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud of. Love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds, 'cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront.
And joining us now in studio is Sebastian Copeland, an award-winning photographer, extreme athlete, filmmaker, author, lecturer, and environmental activist. He's the director of the award-winning feature documentary Into the Cold, A Journey of the Soul, and his books include Antarctica, The Global Warning, which won him the International Press Academy's Photographer of the Year Award, as well as Antarctica, A Call to Action. His latest book, just out, is Arctica, The Vanishing North. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sebastian Copeland.
Thank you, Ian.
And you're just back from Paris, and I obviously want to talk to you about your new book, Arctica, The Vanishing North, which is an extraordinarily beautiful book. I mean, this is I would think this would be a perfect Christmas gift for our audience because it's both an extraordinary portrait of this pristine wilderness that's at threat, but it's also makes you aware of, you know, aware of both the beauty and the terror or the plight of our planet. And of course, But let's talk about Paris first, because you're just back. You were there. You had pretty good access, didn't you?
Yep, I did actually. I was privileged to have the Blue Zone pass, so it gave me access to a lot of discussions, negotiations, and it was interesting the first few days, especially because you know you walk down the halls and all of a sudden, right next to you is Dilma Youssef, and you know down the hall you got all these presidents walking in these tight quarters. So it was there was definitely a real spirit of excitement. It was very different from Copenhagen and many of the other meetings, and you know, and the result is definitely encouraging.
So, do you agree with our previous guests that that even though it's not binding, it's not enforced, at the same time, the mechanism, the name and shame mechanism, in terms of peer pressure, is in there, and the point that I was making is that the reality, I think, is sunk in. There were, I take it, there were no global warming deniers amongst those gathered in Paris, and these are all leaders of 195 countries.
At least they didn't show, they didn't speak out publicly if they were there. You know, it's full of ambiguity. Of course, it's a turning point, I think, in our global understanding of carbon emissions and the role that industrial nations and developing nations play into it. I think it's also a you know, a sign of how complex the issue is to be able to try and put targets that are by definition very, very difficult to either predict and implement. I mean, there are all sorts of feedbacks, and every scientist out there will tell you that to try and put a decimal point to a degree of rise is a little bit like you know, trying to shoot a dart in a moving train. It's just it's not really feasible. So what was really interesting about Paris is the 2 degrees C target, you know, rise relative to industrial levels, was always something that was mostly about PR. You know, it's about a way to reach a universal understanding of a target point and something that people can grab onto. What was interesting about Paris is that discussion came to the 1.5 degrees C, which is actually more realistic, is looking at how can we actually lower that 2C target and get to within a range of something that may not have as powerful feedbacks as what we anticipate with even 2 degrees. Because again, the Earth doesn't know round decimals, right? So,
right.
So getting to a point of two, considering what 0.8C increase right now relative to the 1880s, we're already seeing so many feedbacks and such consequences to that minute increase in temperature that 2 degrees sounds actually quite daunting, in spite of the fact that, of course, you know, objective assessments of Paris say that they point more towards a 3 to 3.5 degrees right. increase.
But for the small Pacific nations, this is an existential issue. And they are among the smallest nations and the poorest nations on the planet. I imagine their leaders made their presence felt.
Yes, you know, that was one of the tough parts of Paris. I spoke actually on a panel, and the minister from Kiribati was there, and I've heard other ministry from small island nations in the Pacific testify, as has, you know, been done so many times before, and it's always heartbreaking. And as well, the Paris Agreement does not factor a shouldering of responsibility by the wealthier nations. So that's certainly one of the you know, the setbacks or the disappointing conclusions of this particular conference. But focusing on the positive, because I think it's very important to recognize, like, look, we've got 196 nations who've come to the table and have actually agreed on a principle that is unprecedented. We haven't seen that happen before. And it really makes a turning point. I think that deniers will either fall in line or fall silent, and let science dominate, as has been the case through history. You know, with Copernicus and Galileo and Darwin, etc. Eventually, science has to prevail. Otherwise, what is the sign of humanity and a search for knowledge?
And again, Sebastian Copeland is joining us in the studio. He's an award-winning photographer, extreme athlete, filmmaker, author, lecturer, and environmental activist. He's the director of the award-winning feature documentary Into the Cold, A Journey of the Soul. And his books include Antarctica, The Global Warning, which won him the International Press Academy's Photographer of the Year Award, as well as Antarctica, A Call to Action. And his latest book just out is Arctica, The Vanishing North. So let's talk about this extraordinary book. It's a hefty tome, right? It's about, what is about 16 inches by 12.
I measure it in pounds.
You measure in pounds. But it's just full of the most amazing photographs of this seldom traveled ethereal North Pole, these amazing landscapes that make you aware of the extraordinary beauty of nature. At the same time, the focus of the book is also to make you also aware that nature is under threat. So this is a pretty risky endeavor, isn't it? I mean, who traveled with you?
Well, in some instances, I traveled with one partner, and in other instances, by myself. So the interaction with the environment is very much part of the pursuit, both on a personal and I suppose you could say almost a spiritual level, but certainly as a photographic quest. Photography in landscape is never a great companion to anyone coming with you, because it's exacting and it's demanding and it's slow. Mm-hmm. And so when you're moving or traveling regions where the temperatures plummet below 40 or 50 below, it's never great fun for somebody to just sit by while you're, you know, trying to line up your shot. The book represents about 10 years worth of intense travel in the Arctic. So I've done some work in Antarctica as well, as you've mentioned previously, with a couple of books. This one represents about 10 years worth of travel. And if I were to put it in amount of mileage under my skis, it's probably about 4,000 kilometers, or about 2,800 miles or so.
So how do you get used to seeing nothing in terms of what we would normally consider activity?
Purely on a photographic level, photography always seeks to isolate or identify a certain subject matter and put it in, you know, raise the awareness to that particular focal point. And that's one reason why photographers generally love deserts. And ice deserts are exactly that. They're barren and empty, and they allow a very selective focus to isolated or individual units or subject matters anyhow. And it allows you to really identify the issues or to create a framework visually that is pleasing to the eye and hopefully raises a certain type of awareness.
So in terms of this being alone in this wilderness, which you've captured this amazing series of portraits, and of course most of us are not going to go there, and they're not likely to go there. So you've done us all a favor in that regard.
Well, that's the idea.
So tell me, though, about witnessing the changes, the melting glaciers, not to mention, wildlife itself.
Sure.
Polar bears are formidable.
Polar bears are formidable. In fact, the book really features quite a few encounters, close encounters at that, with polar bears. But the issue of changes in the Arctic is also quite complex, because it's, as with every other climate issues around the world, they're nonlinear. So you can't actually draw it, a straight stick between one point to the other. You have to look at the trend over decades and whatnot. So invariably that includes science, but it includes as well discussion with locals and with Inuits, who are the first ones to really get the feelings of what it means to have a changing climate. And as well as that, from a pure technical aspect as an explorer, if you will, then you have to look at the condition of the ice that you travel on, especially on the sea ice, on the Arctic Sea, that is, and how that ice is being affected by the melt and freeze cycles. Mm-hmm. And the disappearance of multi-year ice, which is ultimately what's at stake here. You know, we're looking at the Arctic Sea as a as its general density disappearing. And that includes both the index of its extent, which is what you see from satellite observations. But if you're on the ground, it has to do with the thickness of it as well, because surely the thinner the ice is, the quicker it will be to disappear, as scientists predict will happen within the next 20 years or so in the summertime.
And of course, we've all seen pictures of polar bears sort of struggling to find traction aboard a smaller and smaller lily pad of ice, if you will. Is that an illusion or a fact?
It really depends on who you speak with. The Inuit, who have a birthright, if you will, to the to hunting polar bears, but have been imposed quotas by Canada, pressured, of course, by all other nations. I will tell you that there is no decrease in polar bear population, but there's a migration of its numbers towards certain areas. So what we see is essentially migration movements away from certain regions that are getting more and more desolate of polar bear populations, and an increase of concentration in areas where they're going to find more calories or more protein to consume. And that also includes, incidentally, some areas that are more populated by humans. So
are they moving? They're not moving to the colder north. They're moving to the warmer south. Is that what you're saying?
It actually depends on where the concentration of ice is.
I see.
And it's not necessarily always specifically to the north or to the south. It really has to do where there's a mass of cold land that can help generate. I mean, as you understand, ice is motivated by both by water currents and air currents, and the temperatures of those two will essentially determine the concentration of sea ice. Polar bears, by definition, hunt on sea ice because their favorite protein is seals. Also, the easiest for them to hunt because they always come back to the same breathing spot in the winter. Mm-hmm. They create a breathing hole in the ice, and they have to maintain their breathing holes as they're mammals. So they come up from below, and if a bear finds a breathing hole, he can just park himself there and essentially wait for a seal to come up. Mm-hmm. Of course, with the increase in the shortening of the freeze cycle, in other words, the increase of the melt season, those breathing holes are harder and harder to find. And so traditionally, a bear will fast during the summer, and they can lose up to 40% of their body weight. In the wintertime, this is where they gather their mass and eat a lot more. But because the movement of the ice is now changing, especially on the around the Arctic Sea, those populations are moving south in the winter period and finding themselves closer to a lot of communities, for instance, for both the trash and whatnot. So Inuits are seeing more polar bears as a result of that. But then scientists tell us that the numbers are dwindling. So there is, I think, a compromise between the two, and that is a transfer of the population to certain areas.
So Sebastian Koblenz, just alone in the wilderness, up in this extraordinary landscape that is forbidding largely pristine, is there any sound? I mean, you've taken pictures, but I'm trying to imagine sound, what it's like to be out there in this white wilderness.
You know, it's when everything lines up and there's no wind and there's cloud cover and all features disappear to the whiteout, it's a little bit like being lost inside an eggshell. There's no wind. You can pretty much hear your heart booming, and then all features kind of disappear because white is essentially, all-inclusive. It was a great architect, Lewis Kahn, who said that the sun never knew how great it was until it struck the side of a building. And that's really because of the shadow that it generates. And it's the same, of course, with ice. White on white turns out to be a whiteout. and so when it's in that kind of state and there is no wind, then it's both virtually like being kind of lost on a empty canvas, or like a stain on a canvas, I should say. And then, as I said, you can hear your heart booming, and it's a unique experience.
But when you mentioned earlier how you have to be very aware of the ice, particularly the sea ice that you're walking on, did you have any moments of danger?
Well, if you travel in these places, danger is your traveling companion, number one. Of course, yeah, fell through the ice by minus 35 on my way to the North Pole, right clean to my neck. I've been tracked and charged by polar bears. And so there's always danger around. And you're only one piece of equipment failure away from real trouble. So redundancy and certain steps to care for certain types of risks are a necessary part of that type of sojourn. Mm-hmm. But if you're very careful and methodical, which generally is what happens, you know, with most explorers, it's a mindset, then you can mitigate the dangers. But fragile sea ice and increases in open water areas, when you travel to the North Pole in very, very cold temperature, the sea ice is constantly in motion because it's just a thin crust of frozen matter on top of a very deep ocean, and it's subject to the winds and the currents and the tides, and it's constantly in motion as a result of that. There's a drift, etc. And because of that crust of ice, as it's in motion, it cracks open and is eventually reveals big leads, what we call, which are channels of open water. In 30 or 40 below or 50 below temperatures, that ice will freeze over to where you can actually walk on it within just a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. The warmer the temperature, of course, the least likely it is to freeze over, to freeze solid enough for you to walk on. So therein lies the danger, is when you have to, when you find yourself across from a very, very wide lead and you actually have to go swim it. So you don a dry suit, get in the water and pull your sledge that way. Those areas can get larger and larger, and often you can walk on that fragile ice and sadly, you know, as happened to me, go right through it.
Mm. So let's talk about, I mentioned that this is a perfect Christmas gift, this extraordinary book of yours, the 8-pounder that you landed, because it has these amazing pictures of this landscape. So what's your, obviously there's an intention both to share this beauty that, you know, it's so rare, you know, you had to go up there and find it. And we're not about to follow your footsteps, particularly on the fragile ice, and the extent to which you're also warning us about the planet's plight.
Well, I mean, listen, the book is, again, the result of 10 years worth of exploration, many, many months spent on the ice. And I'm a professional photographer, so I started my career as a portraitist. And I sort of tend to look at this as both a way to glorify this environment that's so distant and allow people to have a personal and emotional connection to it. My personal approach is I often think of it as doing portraits of dying people. And that's, you know, essentially what happens with icebergs or with ice in general, is you know that it's transient. It's only there for a short period of time and soon it'll be gone.
Well, your book, again, Arctica, The Vanishing North, is an extraordinary piece of work, and I highly recommend it as a gift to others in this holiday season, particularly a gift that both reminds you of the extraordinary beauty of our planet, but also the fragility and the threat to it. And I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian. It was a pleasure being here.
And again, I've been speaking with Sebastian Copeland. He's an award-winning photographer, extreme athlete, filmmaker, author, lecturer, and environmental activist. He's the director of the award-winning feature documentary Into the Cold, A Journey of the Soul. And his books include Antarctica, The Global Warning, which won him the International Press Academy's Photographer of the Year Award, as well as Antarctica, A Call to Action. And his latest book just out is Arctica, The Vanishing North.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.